Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a state visit from China, more health care debate, and revolution in the Arab world. Chinese President Hu Jintao got the red carpet and a little roasting. Here's his gracious toast at the White House state dinner.
The purpose of my visit is to increase mutual trust, enhance friendship, deepen cooperation, and advance the positive, cooperative, and comprehensive China-U.S. relationship for the 21st century.
The new GOP House majority delivered its promised repeal on health care. Democrats shook their heads, Republicans blasted away. Here's Congressman Doug Lamborn of Colorado.
Obamacare increased costs, explodes the deficit, raises taxes, hurts job creators, and most importantly, gives the government control over personal health care decisions.
And in Tunisia, revolution in the streets and a dictator sent packing, the world heard the rare sound of an Arab popular uprising. We're looking at the news of the week. You can join the conversation. What do you say on China, on mobsters, healthcare, and the GOP, Tunisia? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Ron Brownstein, editorial director and columnist for National Journal, author of The Second Civil War. Ron Brownstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Nancy Youssef is with us, chief Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, also a longtime reporter in the Middle East, served as Baghdad bureau chief. Nancy, great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Ron, let me come to you first, if I may, on China. And after all the, you know, all the trimmings and the 21-gun salute and the Chinese president headed from Washington to Chicago and back, if not already on his way back to Beijing, what's the bottom line out of this big visit, Ron?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that this is a relationship in which some things are going to be moving in a positive direction and some things are going to be moving in a negative direction at all times. And that's the reality, I think, that Americans and especially this administration has come to accept. I mean, we have too many divergent principles from which we approach issues and too many issues in the fire for them all to ever be harmonious, to use the word the Chinese like to use. So in this week, I think there was some progress on Korea in particular. When we talked to administration officials going in, they very much wanted to send the message that China cannot engage with Korea only at points of crisis. North Korea, they have to be a more consistent source of pressure on them to moderate their behavior. And I think that message was delivered very strongly. There was probably a greater emphasis on human rights than earlier in the relationship under Obama, but continued friction on economic issues and the reality that this is a big, growing, more assertive country that is more willing to throw its weight around in the world and to resist our designs. That's just the reality of the relationship at this point.
Nancy Youssef, you're at the Pentagon. We have these reports that the president, in a phone call with President Hu, in his private dinner with President Hu twice, told the Chinese leader that if North Korea wasn't chilled out a little bit here, calmed down somehow, reined in, that the U.S. would have to heighten its military presence in that region. Surely that's designed to get China's attention. How's the Pentagon seeing what went on this week? Were there signs that China may actually do something more with North Korea?
Well, the problem for the Pentagon in dealing with North Korea is that there are 27,000 troops based in Seoul in South Korea, and they're there to protect against all-out war. But in terms of preventing things leading up to all-out war, the military, the U.S. military, has very few options. We saw joint exercises last year happening in the Yellow Sea, which angered China. And the truth is that to bring down the tensions, it hinges on China. So while there was talk about using more exercises and heighten U.S. military presence, in terms of real options, they're very few. And from the Pentagon's perspective, what we hear over and over again is that it hinges on China. That said, the United States is asking a rather opaque country, China, to mitigate another opaque country, North Korea. And so it's a difficult problem for the United States. They can threaten to do more joint exercises, which angers both China and North Korea. But in terms of real tangible shifts in terms of North Korean behavior, it's China that will decide that, not not increased U.S. military presence.
We'll look at the economy, big issue there. North Korea, we have been told China actually, in some ways, given the alternatives, likes the status quo on the Korean Peninsula. Human rights, a word that came up, a phrase that came up repeatedly this week, not as much as some might like. Jack, listen to this one. Here's Congressman Chris Smith, Republican from New Jersey, criticized President Obama from failing to explicitly raise the issue of now Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo, his imprisonment at the joint press conference with Hu Jintao. Here's Smith on NPR's Morning Edition today.
I think it was the least he could say in order to get out of that press conference. But here is the jailer of Liu Xiaobo, and I'm one of those who nominated him to get the Nobel Peace Prize, standing with the 2009 Peace Prize winner, President Barack Obama, and nothing publicly is raised about releasing this man or his wife under de facto house arrest.
Jack Beatty, there's a big relationship here, but big human rights issues. Liu Xiaobo was not there. He's in prison, and he's a Nobel Peace Prize winner, like President Obama. What about that front, Jack?
The empty chair at Oslo. I was watching Chairman Smith's presentation and clicking from that on C-SPAN to the White House ceremonies, and on and Chairman Smith had, you know, Chinese dissidents talking about the torture, about the rollback of key civil rights and political rights just in the last 2 years. You know, heartrending stories, and then you turn to the president's statement. The president says we want to break out of the old stereotype that somehow China is simply taking manufacturing jobs and taking advantage of low wages. Since when is that a stereotype? Since when is that old? And, you know, crucially, human rights is a labor issue. According to a study done for the AFL-CIO about 5 years ago by a Columbia professor, something like, this was in 2006, 1.5 million U.S. jobs were lost to Chinese repression of labor rights. Not that they weren't living up to our standards, they weren't living up to their own standards, and that gave them an advantage. Bonded labor, child labor, prison labor gave them an advantage of sometime between 10% and 77% in the China price. And here's the president saying, well, that's just a stereotype, doesn't really matter anymore.
Of course, he's on the spot. Everybody wants to see economies improving. President Obama and President Hu meeting with American business leaders, all of them talking pretty positively here. Here's President Obama talking on that positive line about the U.S. and Chinese economies.
I believe that over the coming years, we can more than double our exports to China and create more jobs here in the United States. And I'm sure that Chinese business leaders see enormous opportunities here as well.
The Chinese leader happy to pick up that theme. At the U.S.-China Business Council meeting yesterday, President Hu Jintao called for greater economic collaboration.
We can carry out fiscal, financial, and business cooperation on a larger scale, expand exchanges and cooperation in energy, the environment, agriculture, health, and other fields, and broaden cooperation in new areas such as aviation and space, infrastructure, and smart power grid. In this way, we will make our business ties even stronger.
Ron Brownstein, on the economic front, what's your sense of what these two countries each came away with here? Is the United States able to ask, demand this or that anymore? Is it just make nice, hope for the best? What?
Well, I mean, the relationship, we are integrated in many ways on many fronts. I mean, people describe the relationship as too big to fail. But there are real points of conflict that are not going away. And one thing that's striking is the frustration in the American business community, which historically has always been an advocate of prioritizing the economic relationship over human rights. There is increasing frustration in the business community about the terms of the economic relationship. Excuse me. You know, we had debates in the U.S. in the 1980s about domestic content legislation requiring any product sold here to have a certain proportion of its value manufactured here. We didn't go down that route. China uses those kind of tactics on many fronts. I was there last spring for a couple weeks, and you know, you see the emergence of this enormous clean energy industry at the same time that it's the world's largest carbon emitter. So they have a very focused industrial policy. There's a lot of pressure on U.S. companies who want to break into that market to manufacture there, to share intellectual property. And this is something that is not going to be resolved overnight, because as I said, I mean, I think one of the, you know, if you talk to people who do China policy, one of the stories we see is that on this and other fronts, they are more willing to resist our demands, more willing not only to resist our demands, but to organize others to move in different directions than we would prefer. So this is a complex relationship, as I said before, in which we are never going to be at a point where the where the escalator is moving entirely in one direction.
Not resolved overnight, but if there was any a handful of days in which things might be resolved, Nancy Youssef, this would have been it. Do you see the concessions that the White House says it did get, this agreement saying that the Chinese government won't buy pirated software, that they'll be more open to foreign business coming and doing business with the government? Do those look like substantial steps to you, Nancy?
I have to tell you, what I saw more than anything was the relationship no longer going further south for now. Remember when President Obama went to China in November 2009, it was not seen as a successful visit. U.S. military sales to Taiwan further
really aggravated the Chinese, yep.
That's right. And so the relationship was really seen as going south quite quickly, frankly, as early as earlier this month when Secretary of Defense Robert Gates went to China and they tested their J-20 aircraft fighter jet while he was there. So I think the best thing that came out of this trip was that the relations are not getting worse. Now, whether the rhetoric that we heard and those moderate gains that we saw will lead to a move forward remains to be seen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. China's president comes visiting. Republicans gear up in Congress. President Obama up in the polls. And revolution in the Arab world in Tunisia. Really something to see. We'll talk about it. Ron Brownstein is with us from National Journal. Nancy Youssef from McClatchy Newspapers, the chief Pentagon correspondent there. Jack Beatty's here. Let's get our listeners in here on this big relationship. Mike in Brattleboro, Vermont. You're on the air, Mike.
Yes, hi. I just have a kind of a discrepancy with the Nixon era when the Chinese first opened up their ping pong policy, and then all of a sudden we handed everything to China. We were so anxious to get these people in here. I do hold the American businesses responsible for this because they managed to give it all away.
But they need to do business there, don't they? I mean, isn't that the way the world works? Don't we have to be in China?
There's a limit. I mean, when you start giving aeronautics information and aerospace technology away, you have to send in the president to get that, because that's just not done by a couple of greedy American business people. This is just, to me, a disgrace. There should be a stop and a ban on giving anything more to China. You walk down the street and they grab your shirts, they grab your shoes, they grab your shirt, and they want to make it. And 2 weeks later, it's on the market in Saks Fifth Avenue.
We got it. I appreciate your call. Let me take it to Jack Beatty, if I may. I mean, Jack, it was just, just in the last few days, GE, I believe it was, that announced the big aerospace or aeronautics deal with China, and technology transfer came with that. This is a big demand China makes. It's a demand. You want to do business here? Bring some technology with you. Our caller says don't give it away, but Americans, that's been the price they've had to or been willing to pay American business to get into that market.
Yes, but as Ron has suggested, they're less willing to pay it, and the price is rising, mm-hmm. and it seems to be part of the Chinese mercantilist strategy. Yes, you can come here. Yes, you can do business, but you got to share your secrets, and you know that allows them to build their own industry in parallel to that. But as to Mike's point about imports, the one that got me this week is that the statuettes of American presidents, their little metal statuettes sold at the Smithsonian, where are they made? China. You go from that on the one hand to what we read just recently in Massachusetts. There was a company in Devens, Massachusetts. It was at the frontier of solar research. It got government grants. It started out with a bang 2 years ago. It's gone now to China because it couldn't compete on price. The Chinese have essentially targeted that industry. That's how mercantilists work. Meanwhile, over here, we say, well, we can't have any national economic strategy. That's planning.
That's planning. Well, okay, there's a lot of debate about whether or not that works. Ron, I hear you there.
Yeah, Tom, you know, what's interesting, I mean, it is true that China uses all sorts of government carrots and sticks to expand its role in these industries, but there's a self-sustaining or critical mass quality of this that goes beyond the government policy at this point. When you talk to companies about why they are locating in China, particularly manufacturing, it's not only to be in that market, it's because the global supply chain now runs through China. It is a fulcrum or a hub, really, of the assembly of so many of these products that may be downsourced into Vietnam or Thailand or elsewhere. And companies feel they have to be – that's where the customers are. That's where the production is moving, and they have to be part of that. And as Jack says, the real issue for us, I think, is how we respond and whether we need a more integrated and systematic strategy to restore our own productive capacity. I would just say very quickly, in the polling that we do here at National Journal, our quarterly polls on the economy, there is a surprising constituency for those kinds of ideas, given that really nobody in national life have talked about them since the 1980s, when you had people like Dick Gephardt and Robert Reich. Mm-hmm. So there actually is an audience that feels as though the U.S. cannot exist solely by evolving toward a service economy, and that in fact, when faced with this kind of systematic strategy, perhaps we need to find ways to strengthen our own core industries as well.
We'll be back to that, and this relationship may be the story of the century. GOP getting geared up after the Tucson week of pause last week. This week it was a repeal vote in the House, where the Republicans have that majority, on health care reform, 245-189. Three Democrats joining all 242 Republicans in support of the repeal, and ambitions, looking right on from there. The repeal won't come to pass through the Senate and the White House, but here's Michelle Bachmann talking big about where she sees things headed.
This body will cast a vote to repeal Obamacare. And to those across the United States who think this may be a symbolic act, we have a message for them. This is not symbolic. This is why we were sent here. And we will not stop until we repeal a president and put a president in the position of the White House who will repeal this bill.
So there's a vote on the repeal. It may not repeal it, but Michelle Bachmann, Republican of Minnesota, looking already to the next presidential election. House Democrats pushing back. Here's New York Democrat Anthony Weiner calling the whole move, the repeal vote, short-sighted, speaking here with MSNBC.
They said, well, we're going to repeal all this stuff, and then we're going to get to what our ideas are. But they have no idea what they are. That's the challenge the Republicans face. And also something else was very interesting on the floor today. More than a few times they said, oh, yeah, we like stopping people from being kicked off for pre-existing conditions. We like the idea that you're covering the donut hole. We like the idea that young people are getting insurance. But we're still going to repeal it.
North Montpelier, Vermont. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, it's interesting that John Boehner came in and the first thing he said is he's going to break gridlock in Washington. And then they turn around and the first thing they do is they want to repeal health care.
What do you think, that's more gridlock? Or is that, that's not gridlock, that's our path to the White House.
And then, you know, they talk about how the health care legislation would lose jobs, and it's going to a job-busting bill. But in fact, they're quoting the Congressional Budget Office, which says, yeah, we may lose 650,000 jobs, but that's because there are all those people that are working only to maintain their health care. And if those people got health care and were able to retire, that seems to me would open up a whole lot of jobs for people that want to work.
Bob, let us go to it. Ron Brownstein, I'm going to come back first to you on this one. What do you make of this? The debate is back. The vote was there solidly with that Republican majority for repeal. Of course, it won't go anywhere. But what does this mean? What's cooking here?
Well, I think that this is both a symbolic and consequential vote at the same time. As you suggest, this immediate vote will not go any further. The Senate is not going to vote to repeal, and if somehow it did, the president would have the veto to defend his bill. But it is really a signal of the extent to which opposition, root and branch, to the health care law is a litmus test in the Republican Party. Every member, as you noted, voted against it. It is really a sign that we are going to see from Red America opposition to this by any means necessary, by every means available, for a long time. I mean, without drawing a moral equivalence, I think the last time you have seen as much of the country resist a major federal initiative probably is Brown versus Board of Education. Virtually every state with a Republican governor and attorney general is suing to overturn the individual mandate. Most of them are suing to overturn the expansion of Medicaid. Republican governors are resisting implementation, and I think you will see guerrilla warfare over the next 2 years. What you haven't seen, as I think Anthony Weiner correctly pointed out, is a Republican alternative that makes any meaningful dent on the interrelated, integrated problem of rising costs and declining access. You know, the Congressional Budget Office says that the alternative that Republicans put forward would cover only 3 million of the uninsured over the next decade. We'd still have over 50 million people without health insurance. And in our magazine today, even Douglas Holtz Aiken, who was McCain's policy director in 2008, former director of the Congressional Budget Office, says that is not a serious proposal. They do not have a serious replace idea out there. But it's pretty clear that from this vote, I would not just kind of look at this as symbolism. It is a marker of how much commitment there is in the Republican coalition to a sustained trench warfare against this law. And there will be many more acts and many more fronts in this struggle.
Nancy Youssef, you know Washington well. What do you see here on the Democrat side then? Are they ready to draw the line in the sand, stand firm on stand firm on health care reform, or is it a compromise posture? Let's talk. Let's see what we can work out in Congress.
Well, the indications we've gotten so far is the latter, that there's talk about at least a little bit of compromise. Steny Moyer, the Democrat from Maryland, said we'll talk about good ideas as they come forward, as the Republicans appear to be attacking this bill maybe piecemeal and looking for small changes where it can. So the line in the sand, as you say, isn't as clear as maybe some would hope. I couldn't help but think, as we were talking about the Republicans and their lack of alternative ideas, I wonder how much they really need an alternative idea when the perception out there is that this is a costly bill at a time of financial and fiscal concern, and at a time when it's seen as a jobs killer, given the economic status, the status of the economy right now. I wonder how much they need an alternative when the perception of the current bill is so damning.
Yeah, Ron, what do the numbers show?
Well, first of all, the polling is more mixed on it. Even on Election Day, and when the Democrats were being spanked to the worst loss since 1938 in the midterm, the country divided in half over whether to maintain or repeal. What they've never been able to do is basically convince the white electorate that it will benefit them and their family, even if they think it might be good for the country overall. But the reason why the Republican posture is inadequate isn't really about politics. It's about reality. There are 50 million Americans without insurance. 30 million of them live in states with Republican governors today. There are 100 House Republicans in districts where the share of the uninsured exceeds the national average. Those people are not going away, and repealing the bill does not make them go away. You still have the same problems of costs being shifted as hospitals and doctors have to provide uncompensated care. You know, you look into states like Texas and Florida, where roughly a quarter of the population is uninsured, and steady as she goes posture, or not really trying to tackle that problem, that creates distortions by itself. The reason this bill passed, Tom, in the first place, after every other president failed, was because enough of the medical industry said we can't keep going on. The doctors and hospitals and drug companies that had opposed all previous efforts at reform supported it. And I think that those interests themselves would be uncomfortable with a posture that says, let's just let this go, repeal the bill, move up to 60 million uninsured. There's a lot of dislocation in the system that involves.
Jack, maybe the GOP is looking at that quarter of the population in some states without and thinking we don't need them to win elections.
I think that's their calculation. Paul Krugman says it straight out. He says they are against reform because it would cover the uninsured, and they simply do not want to cover the uninsured, partly out of a kind of moral idea that people should just look after themselves. How long can you go on ignoring such a block of voters? How long can you go on ignoring the vested interests the Democrats have created thus far with the bill? Again and again in the debate, you saw a Republican congressman would say something, the Democrat would get up, I don't know how they coordinate this, and say, let's see, in your district, 9,462 young people up to the age of 26 are now being insured. Pre-existing conditions are now waived. The hospital so-and-so in your district is getting this. Those are vested interests even before the full you know, implementation of the bill. And each time the Republicans oppose the bill on ideological grounds, there are these practical issues. You've got voters out there who now have a stake.
Yes, that's the Democrat line this week. On the other hand, I heard a prominent Texas Republican saying, talking about his mom, but my mom, when she needed a particular kind of care, she got it under this system. And maybe Republicans will put forward, I mean, they've got these ideas about more access, more open markets for health care, what that can cover. I don't know. Eddie in Iowa City, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I think the fact that the Republicans chose to name the bill the jobs killing bill is indicative of the fact that they seem to think that they can continue to throw monkey wrench into the process and feel that that continues to make the uncertainty that they keep talking about for the business community a reality. And frankly, I believe that their passage of this bill in the House of Representatives is as significant to the United States government and to the people of the United States as the 1994 Congress passing term limits.
But Eddie, when Republicans say, look, we were elected to do this, what do you say to that? There they are. They've got that majority, and they said, this is why we were sent here. So shouldn't they, in that case, if that's what they believe, be doing it?
Absolutely. And it's as significant as term limits was in 1994. It doesn't amount to anything. It's just blowing smoke.
We'll see how much smoke is blown. I want to ask about this push, Ron Brownstein, on spending. This big Republican Study Committee, big conservative bloc, two-thirds of House Republicans are members, calling for at least $100 billion in cuts right away and for $2.5 trillion over the next decade, and exempting a lot, exempting military, exempting Medicare, Social Security, which means it would come right down on all the other spending. Has that got legs? If two-thirds of the GOP members are in that group, will the others have to follow? Could it move?
Well, I think that over time, the direction of the Republican Party is in that direction. I mean, I think there is no question, and that really kind of will frame the debate, I think, in a sharp way. I mean, Republicans historically have done best framing the debate in the broadest philosophical term. Americans are resistant to what they consider big government. Generally, when you ask people, should government be doing more or less, they say less. Democrats always believe their trump card is the individual programs, that people may not like government in general, but they like aid to education. They like building highways. They like research. They certainly like Medicare and Social Security. And you see in the new poll out today from the New York Times that ambivalence. You know, where this really could come to a head is on Medicare. You know, you mentioned that Republican member saying, you know, my mother had access to that
yep.
service. The Republicans, on the one hand, have criticized the reductions in Medicare spending in the health care bill. On the other hand, they are, you know, they have touted an idea that would fundamentally end Medicare as it now exists and replace it. Medicare would go from being a defined benefit program where you're guaranteed services to being a defined contribution program. A government would give you a check to go buy insurance from private insurers. That's the Paul Ryan plan. Four-fifths of House Republicans voted for that in 2009. Not clear if they will wade back into those waters again this year. But what that – like the Republican Study Committee budget cuts – The voucherizing of Medicare really kind of takes this down from the abstraction into the specific. And that is, if Republicans can win that argument, obviously they will be in a very strong position. But it is a very different argument than we've been having about the kind of the expansion of government or government in broader ideological terms.
But the argument is on. And as we heard already there, Michelle Bachmann framing it very much in 2012 terms
yes.
already. Nancy, what about that little spike, 8-point spike, not so little, in President Obama's polling numbers this week? What do you assign that to?
Well, it's interesting. I think a lot of it had to do with his response to the shooting of Congresswoman Giffords and the sort of national unity speech he gave. Some could argue that it's a balance from the legislation that was passed during the lame duck session of last year. They are high numbers, but these polls are fickle, so
yeah.
I don't think anyone at the White House is celebrating quite yet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Mark Kelly, husband of wounded Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, told ABC's Diane Sawyer about his wife's progress and his hopes.
I think if anybody could recover from this, it's her. And so I'm confident that she's going to, you know, she'll make a full recovery.
He's hoping. One of the largest mob busts in history yesterday, Johnny Pizza Jr., Lollipops, Jimmy Gooch, and a lot more. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder.
Defendants from numerous La Cosa Nostra families have been charged, including defendants from all five New York-based families, the Bonanno, Colombo, Gambino, Genovese, and Lucchese families.
And a punchy awards night at the Golden Globes as host Ricky Gervais let fly zinger after zinger.
It's going to be a night of partying and heavy drinking. Or as Charlie Sheen calls it, breakfast.
We're looking at a week in the news. China's president in Washington, Republicans gearing up in Congress, a revolution in the Arab world. Go to Tunisia. Ron Brownstein is with us from National Journal, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and our own Jack Beatty. Nancy, take us to this Tunisia story. Absolutely sends chills up and down your back to see what's going on there. A dictator of many years, 23 years of autocratic rule, Ben Ali out really after the people went into the streets and the military would not shut them down on his behalf. What's it mean, Nancy?
You know, it's funny, as someone who's watched the region and traveled to the region my whole life, I didn't believe it was happening as it was happening. You know, these are police states, and Tunisia had a particularly tight control on its population. And yet they were quite ostentatious, the first family, about the wealth and that they were taking from the people as the middle class dwindled there. It was an extraordinary sight, and it's really shaken up the Arab world. I talked to my friends from Iraq, and they say, we wish the same thing had happened here. You talk to people in Egypt, and they say that we wish the same thing would happen here. It's extraordinary and totally unexpected, and in Tunisia in particular. It was a liberal state, and again, one that... that had a particularly tight control on its population. And so what's interesting to me is what effect WikiLeaks may have had in all this. There were a number of cables that came out from the U.S. ambassador to Tunisia pointing out that the government of Ben Ali had essentially lost touch with the Tunisian people.
Not to mention turned into a pretty complete kleptocracy.
That's right. And I don't know how else to say it, and forgive me if it sounds crass, but I can't help but think that there was a feeling in Tunisia, my goodness, even the Americans can see what's happening here in our country. It's been amazing to watch. I have to say, I'm not ready to celebrate yet because we don't know what's going to emerge next. And we're already starting to see some of the strain in forming the post-Ben Ali government. There's discussions about whether ministers should be allowed to stay in as a way of transition until the elections are held 6 months from now. The people of Tunisia are saying no. And also from the United States perspective, will this lead to more stability and an ally in Tunisia or not? And so there's a lot that remains to be to determined, and how that all plays out, I think, will really shape the rest of the region. I thought it was funny at the Arab summit this week, they talked about giving more economic aid in Egypt and Jordan as though this will undo years of living under a police state and a dwindling middle class. So it's for those of us who've watched the region all our lives, it's still in a funny way hard to believe that it's happening.
A kind of political earthquake right there in the heart of the Arab world, in Northern Africa anyway. Here's Tunisian Prime Minister now, Mohamed Ghannouchi, with this new tone, announcing Monday that a new political openness was coming to his country, Tunisia.
The government has decided to free all the people imprisoned for their ideas, their beliefs, or for having expressed dissenting opinions. Our top priority is to issue a draft pardon act, and the government promises to open all channels of dialogue with all the unions and syndicates, and will allow them free function and speech.
Free function, free speech, people, you know, free on ideas and beliefs and dissent. Ron Brownstein, this is a whole new tone. Does Washington pull in behind this? They were supportive in a muted kind of way as it went on. We did see Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was it just last week, with these dire warnings to the Arab world, you know, change or be in big trouble. But now that this is actually here, Nancy Youssef says she can barely believe it. Her family's from Egypt. She can barely believe it. But does the U.S. run with this or tap the brakes?
Well, I think that their hesitance so far has shown you that they are not 100% certain. But as you note, it comes just after that very pointed message from Hillary Clinton. So you would think that if this does evolve in a direction, and Nancy, I will certainly defer to Nancy in her analysis of the situation on the ground, that if this does evolve in a direction that does seem to be more consistently positive, it's hard to imagine they would not embrace it. I mean, obviously in the Middle East, the extent to which the analogy can be applied to other countries is limited. But certainly whenever there have been kind of breaks through the concrete, really, the kind of the hardened concrete of authoritarianism across the region, U.S. In recent years, obviously not in the 1950s, but in recent years, U.S. policymakers have wanted to celebrate them. So I would imagine that if they feel this is solidifying, they would do so, but they're not there yet.
Big rippling – yes, Nancy.
Just wanted to elaborate on this idea of free ideas that are emerging. On one hand, it's wonderful. We're starting to see the press in Tunisia working much as the press does here. They're no longer required to put pictures of Ben Ali and his wife Layla on the front page every day, and they're quite excited about this, and they're having a very frank dialogue in their papers. But I noticed today in the Washington Post on its front page, the photo of the protesters, a woman there was wearing a hijab. And this was in a country where hijabs were banned in public buildings. And so the free ideas goes both ways in terms of whether to lead to more conservative or more liberal society. The other thing I wanted to point out, and I couldn't help having spent so many years in Iraq and now in Afghanistan, you know, we saw in Iraq it took nearly a year for the government to form. Right now in Afghanistan, there's a stalemate over the parliament and whether Hamid Karzai will let certain winners take their seats. I can't help but think that perhaps the lesson in all this is that democracies in the region emerge best when they are organic and come from the streets versus from outside forces. It's taken months to seat governments in Iraq and Afghanistan because people we've empowered are not ready to relinquish that power. And here, something that started out so small has led to such a revolution, and it's inspiring the Middle East in a way the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have not.
You may have seen a hijab in the crowd in the photo, Nancy, but I've heard Tunisians saying this week, you know, don't put us in this box if it's either despotism or, you know, Islamic radicalism, Al-Qaeda, saying that's what the French, that's how Sarkozy looked at their country. So I think he said something like, you know, what do you want, Ben Ali, this dictator, or Al-Qaeda down there? I've heard Tunisians saying, no, don't lock us into that polarity. That's not what we want. That's not what we're about. Do you believe that, Nancy?
I absolutely believe that. But the question becomes, how does that get resolved, and who prevails, and how is that received in the rest of the region? It's this month's future we're going into of instability that leaves me a little bit cautious in terms of what this will mean. I think I just want to caution against assuming that this will lead to more stability. We don't know yet. And I think the reason you're seeing a muted response from the United States is because of that. The reality is it may lead to, at least in the short term, some instability.
But isn't that exactly the point? People aren't talking really about it leading to more stability anytime soon. Aren't they rather saying you've got a whole region here that could and maybe should come unbuckled from the despots who have been in charge?
Right, but at what cost is what I'm asking. I mean, look, I can speak to Egypt best. There is a lot that the United States benefits from because of Mubarak in charge. There is a cost in that instability potentially to the United States, and I think it's just something worth considering as we go forward. It could lead to a revolution of an unprecedented revolution. It could also lead to more conservative and less pro-American leaders in places like Egypt, like Jordan, and even like Saudi Arabia. And so that's what makes it so extraordinary. The people there are thrilled and excited, and it's captivating to watch. But as the American in me is also a little nervous about what it will mean for U.S. relations in the Middle East and what could come out of it. It's the uncertainty that has me nervous.
Jack, there are the horns of the American dilemma, but I don't know if it should be a dilemma. We've said for years we want democracy in this region. Let me get a call, and I'll come to you, Jack. Thomas in Somerville, Massachusetts. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for letting me call. Regarding the Tunisians,
yes,
it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that back in 1776 we had a revolution, and were we having this talk show in Britain at that time,
yeah.
we would be discussing the same problems that you're Pentagon correspondent simply discussed. Would it lead, our revolution lead to instability? Would we come out of it all right, et cetera, et cetera?
Right.
And we can say the same thing about the tepid American response to the Tunisian revolution is really a betrayal, I think, of everything that the United States is supposed to stand for.
Thomas, I really appreciate your call. You become the big power, Great Britain then, the United States now, and you may look at liberty and interests a little differently. That doesn't mean we should. Here, Jack, is a little bit from a political analyst at the University of Jordan. This is Mohammed Al-Masri, saying that Arab governments, and many of them have close ties to the United States, must now change in the wake of Tunisia's revolution or face a similar fate.
Arab regimes have two choices now, to impose more repression, which was the system adopted by Ben Ali's regime and ended easily, or political openness, freedom and diversity within powers that rule based on consent of political parties to create national governments that take into consideration people's need for a sway from corruption.
There's the choice, he says, Jack. How are you watching all this? It's quite a demonstration by the Tunisian people in the streets. They've had a kind of success I don't recall in the Arab world.
No, I've never seen anything like this. It's moving. And ominous in some ways, perhaps, as Nancy says. And yet, on the other hand, you know, roll the clock back. What did we learn at 9/11? Remember all the articles that said, you know, the wages of stability in the Arab world, making that our main goal, is exported terrorism. We get identified with the regimes. The regimes are cruel. The people they're cruel to, the regimes somehow refract their anger at them toward the West, and you get 9/11. Well, that's part of the root of our whole problem with terrorism now. And the model, at least after 9/11, was, well, slowly there'll be reform in the Arab world, and they'll let the tea kettle off, they'll let it off the boil just a little bit, a little more represent. Instead, what have we had? We've had sclerosis. You know, you have autocracies, you have oligarchies, you have the Mubarak father and son situation in Egypt. You know, perhaps there's some change here and there, but nothing substantive. And you just wonder, how long can U.S. Diplomats repeat that mantra about stability first, not recognizing that the wages of stability partly is terrorism.
Or talk democracy and stability in a region that doesn't have the former. David in Columbia, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I do want to agree with Nancy in general, but in particular, we have to realize that there's certain situations that we don't pay much attention to here in the United States. In Egypt, you know, we wish for the best and we wish for democracy, but if you just look at what the situation is for the Copts inside that country...
You're talking the Christian sect there.
It could actually get so bad that we could be looking at a Holocaust.
Nancy, what about it? There has been a persistent stream of headlines on violence against Christians out of that neighborhood. Concerns now in the Sudan, which has voted for this separation, that they want to push Christians, who are more populous in the south, out of the north. You know, what about the tolerance when it comes to democracy in this region?
Well, you know, I have, in my travels in Egypt, I have found that Egyptians are particularly tolerant of Christians. It's a big majority in Egypt. It's 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And up until the invasion in Iraq, they were quite welcome in Iraq as well. We've seen attacks against Christians increase in both Iraq and Egypt just in the last few months. My own personal read of this is an al-Qaeda attempt to divide and almost ethnically cleanse out those countries. In Iraq, it's a dwindling minority, and there are very few left. And in Egypt, although
15% is pretty hard
to
cleanse out.
But they represent economically far more than that in Egypt. And so it's a stab at that as well. But what we're talking about is sort of a boiling tea kettle here throughout the region. And it's just, to me, fascinating and nerve-wracking to watch at the same time, because you just don't know what's next. My hope is that it leads to something fantastic, and yet I, you know, it's almost personal for me because I have so many friends in the region. I worry about their safety. I worry about what's going to come of this, and I worry about the in between. But the caller brings up a great point, and Jack mentioned it as well, that we can't talk about stability and democracy in the same way. In a way, the U.S. sort of efforts in the region have contradicted one another, and we saw that in those WikiLeaks cable from the ambassador to Tunisia. He says this argument that we make that Tunisia is our friend, they are not. It is a corrupt government. They've lost touch with the people. He makes that point, and the dwindling middle class is getting more and more angry with it, with this government, the one that we have supported.
Nancy, I want to swing back home for one more call here. Forgive me, Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Make it quick, my friend. We've just got a minute.
Hi, Tom. In Spokane Monday, three city workers found a live bomb at the Martin Luther King Day parade.
Yeah, in a backpack by the parade route.
Yeah, domestic terrorism. They've been, for the last 30 years, they've been having anti-government and white supremacist activity in that area. But the media has ignored the story, and in general, the media has ignored right-wing anti-government violence. And my question is, why does the media underreport domestic violence by right-wing hate groups, and why has it failed to confront Republicans on their 30-year-long systematic effort to convince Americans that its elected government is the enemy?
Mark, our time is short. Ron Brownstein, thankfully, thank heavens that bomb did not go off. It was discovered. But you hear our callers saying, wait, are we looking closely enough at this? After the Tucson shootings, are we talking enough about it?
Well, I think certainly the Department of Homeland Security had a extensive study that came out several months ago on kind of the risks of domestic terrorism. And look, the other side of the coin, not mentioned, not right-wing violence, but radicalization, domestic radicalization of kind of Islamic terrorism, which is clearly a growing challenge that the administration is being compelled to put more attention to.
Well, we're keeping an eye on the whole world here and grateful to each of you for helping us do it. Ron Brownstein with the National Journal, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being here today, Ron.
Thank you.
And Nancy Youssef with McClatchy Newspapers, chief Pentagon correspondent there. Nancy, thank you so much, and we appreciate your open heart sort of communication on Tunisia. Thank you, Nancy.
It's my pleasure.
Jack, thanks so much for joining us. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
And listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.